Donaldson on alto sax with Blues Walk, the title track of his 1958 album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Free Your Mind Friday. This is our weekly open forum in which you're free to talk about any subject that you wish. What's on your mind? And of course, we hope that it is a pretty strong opinion, that you have a pretty strong opinion about something, and you will share it with us, and don't be surprised if people react to what you say. I'm sure you'd be able to defend yourself if it comes to that. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. 888-874-4888. This is one of the things I've always insisted on when I'm doing radio, of course, that we must reserve some time just to free fall. We just talk about things without a script. And, you know, it would be one thing if I prepare a program. And, of course, I know what, you know, we'll be following the plan for the program. But you've got to have some space as well, it seems to me, to take the program where you want it to go. And that's what our Free Your Mind Friday is all about. Jay from New York, you're going to start us off today.
Yes, good afternoon, Eutrice. How are you?
Okay, Jay. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Listen, two quick things. Number one, in regards to the suppression of the election in Georgia and Florida, I just hope that the people will stand firm and try to get every vote counted. Because if they do, it looks like the two individuals that they tried to suppress will be the governors of that state, which will be interesting. You know, it seems that Gilliam is a weak individual, and it seems that is a strong individual.
He's a weak individual now.
I think he's a weak individual.
Ooh, okay.
And the reason why I say that he's weak is he gave up too quick.
I'll tell you why I think it is.
I think it is because his backers told him to. See, you got to look at who surrounds him. And to be honest with you, I don't see too many people of color surrounding either one of them, but the sister showed me the type of fight that could get my support. She didn't just capitulate and go along. She stood firm. She stood up, and she attacked back. She didn't fall back like Gilliam did, in my opinion. I could be wrong. I want you to fight to the bitter end for my vote. But let me leave you with the last thing, because I know there's other callers. Donald Trump, 45, is losing his mind. And his racist attitude and behavior toward black women is sickening. And he must be called out. Oh, and I forgot this. This is something that I think you will enjoy. If Nancy Pelosi does not give the black members of the CBC their rightful positions as the head of committees in the Congress, black voters will finally turn against the Democratic Party, I believe. And the person that will lead it will be the Reverend Perm Daddy Al Sharpton. That's who will lead it. Because you treat, though, Treese, I know you're laughing, but listen, if she do not allow Maxine Waters to have the position as the head that she's entitled to, it's going to be hell to pay from people like Al Sharpton, the Joe Madisons, and the others who have control over the mindset of our people. Watch me. Look, you may laugh about it, but they're going to go nuts.
This is politics, and anything is possible.
Have a good day,
apart from what you want, this is politics, and anything is possible. Gary from Hempstead, you're on the air.
Noon.
Hello, good afternoon to you.
Hi. To Latrice, I'm calling in today because I was a bit troubled by a conversation earlier in the week. I believe it was Monday, concerning voting. And I believe I'm going to try to restate your position accurately. You did not believe that we should be voting or participating in the voting process.
Wrong.
And I'm sorry, was that accurate?
No, not at all.
Okay, please correct me.
I do not tell people what to do. I merely, and I've talked about it so many times before, walking people through my decision that I arrived at, and I said to myself, I will not vote until, to me, there is a compelling reason to vote. I haven't found a compelling reason.
Well, I tend to differ with you on that relative to compelling reasons. I don't have a lot of confidence or trust in the political process, but somebody has to be in that seat. And I think, as your speaker yesterday, Dr. Horn, said, voting is just one of the tools in our toolkit. If I have the opportunity to put someone who in a position of power who's going to make decisions affecting my life and my community and my children, and one person is going to okay legislation that's going to contaminate my water and air, and the other person is going to perhaps take a different direction, or one person is going to support public education, of which I'm a product of, and the other person is trying to, defund it and derail it. If some person is going to take my tax dollars and gives it to wealthy people and someone else has a different perspective, I think that's a compelling reason to put someone in a position who will act to some degree on your behalf. I think they all act in their self-interest, but I mean, that's my perspective.
Well, and you're correct. It's your perspective. My perspective is I refuse, I absolutely refuse to be part of a sham. And much of what has passed for politics is largely a sham. It was the same position I took with regard to Barack Obama. I did not vote for Barack Obama because I understood what he represented, in his early life in Chicago, it looked clear to me, and it turned out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy, actually, that the people surrounding Barack Obama had, there was no plan about communities in distress. What do you do about communities in distress? And why are we so casual about the business of, well, here's a black guy, let's vote for him? No, he's a black guy with a spotty history. And when I say spotty, I'm talking about in terms of the relationship to the community. It is very important to me. Very important to me. And I just couldn't overlook it.
I happen to agree with you. When
Jesse Jackson was running, and I was the editor of a newspaper, it was the only black newspaper in the country that refused to endorse him, calling him a charlatan and saying that Jackson was not really dedicated. He wanted to look like he was dedicated, but he was not dedicated to doing the work. And we don't have time to indulge people in their fantasies. They want power. Fine. Tell me, what is the plan? You have no plan.
Here's the problem I have, and I agree with you. I agree with you. The problem I have is, what is the alternative? The political structure, the process, the machinery is corrupt to the core. So I don't know that getting an independent party person will remedy that situation. Because the process is greased by money.
I understand all of that. But at the same time, I think there ought to be some basic qualifications that we should expect. And I didn't see them happening in those candidates. Certainly they're not happening with Donald Trump. I'm under no illusions about politics. Let me tell you that. Right. No illusions whatsoever. Politics is a straight business, and I've been preaching for years about this. We have to become, I use the word, entrepreneurial. We have to look about to what is the return on our investment. It's not just about, well, you got to get out and vote, and then you have Oprah Winfrey saying something repulsive like, if you don't vote, you're dishonoring your ancestors. What is that? No. You vote because the person or persons that are presenting themselves for your vote, whether they measure up. I'm not about to go into a fantasy again for another 4 years, and then you elect the person, they forget that you even exist, let alone the issues that are paramount to you and your community. They do nothing. The only relationship they seem to have with their own community is a predatory one, and I think we ought to end it. We ought to end that cycle. Stop it dead in its tracks.
On a final note, I was curious of your thoughts. I believe your prior speaker had made this point a couple of weeks ago or a month ago with the Kavanaugh situation, where he felt that was white folks' business. Do you have a similar feeling that we should be, the black community, disengaged from concerns about who is on the Supreme Court?
I don't dare presume tell the black community what it ought to do or not do. That's your job. You know, make up your own mind.
What's your position on his statement?
But live with the decision, though. Live with the decision you're making. Live with it. So, you know, I've already said, to me, the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't bother me. What we ought to look at is the slaughter, the genocide occurring at the lower court level. We keep going along with white America's arguments and concerns about the U.S. Supreme Court and all the things that concern them, but that's their agenda. Our agenda should be what the heck is going on at the lower court level, the criminal courts, even traffic court. People don't get a fair shake.
Yeah, but decisions are the final arbitrator of decisions that are appealed get to the Supreme Court.
But you know, that's a myth. That is a myth. The U.S. Supreme Court mathematically will not hear even 1% of all the cases tried in the United States in any given term.
Right.
So that already tells me, put your attention elsewhere.
Understood.
Number two is that the cases that they hear are cases that the judges elect to hear. Right. They don't have to hear these cases. They decide which cases that they will hear, which means that perhaps for every case that they decide to hear, there are probably 10,000 cases they're deciding not to hear.
Right.
We don't know the reason. We don't know why they select this particular case as opposed to that particular case. That's their prerogative, and it's quite arbitrary. It is arbitrary in the sense that they vote to hear cases that, in their opinion, are significant. Does it mean that the cases are so significant that they cover all communities equally? No. I start from the point of view that the court system is itself a tool of oppression, Supreme Court or not.
Yeah.
So we need to see some movement going on to re-examine the operations of the lower courts. That's where people of color in this country are slaughtered.
True. You know, to your point, I was sickened about a week or so ago when I heard that Democrats allowed Republicans to push through 15 federal judges without any debate so that they could recess early.
Well, actually, it's more than 15.
Oh, okay.
This guy who quit recently, Don Gahn, before he left, under 2 years,
okay, who, McGahn?
He was in the Trump administration.
Right.
81 federal judges. He put them in. 81.
Right. McGahn, Don McGahn.
Yes.
Yeah, the White House counsel.
Right, the White House counsel. Blah. He's there for, you know, under 2 years. He got 81 federal judges appointed.
Right. I think Trump has had the highest number of any president.
Well, here's the problem I'm having, you see. He gets 81 judges appointed. He gets 2 U.S. Supreme Court judges appointed.
Yeah.
So the question I had asked the audience is, what's a natural question we should be asking here? The question we should be asking is, how is it possible that Barack Obama can close the door behind him after 8 years in office, and with 81 vacancies? Are you crazy?
Yes, I see your point.
Okay, then.
Thank you so much, and love you and appreciate the forum that you're allowing us to participate in.
Thank you. I really do enjoy it.
Have a wonderful weekend.
Jason from Ohio. Thank you. You too. Jason from Ohio, you're on the air.
Hey, Trees.
Hey.
Thanks so much for all you do. And I wanted to run this by you. When Jeff Sessions was originally going through the confirmation hearings, I guess in the beginning before he took took his office, whatever position. One of the, I guess, senators or congressmen, Grassley, I don't remember which one, he asked him what he's going to do, because, you know, the whole campaign had a great rhetoric of lock her up, and, you know what I mean, the Clinton Foundation, and that she needs to be in jail and all that stuff, right? So the theater, the theatrics, and the rhetoric that Trump was going to, if he had his way, she would have been in jail a long time ago, right? And so Grassley, in the hearings, asked or pressed Sessions, because he tried to kind of evade the question. What does he intend to do about the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton email investigation and all the fraud and all the garbage that she's been involved with her wonderful cohort there, husband and all that stuff? And he specifically answered, just straight out, clearly, right there and then. He said, I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to step aside and not do anything at all whatsoever. So would you say that he should have been eliminated right from the get-go if Trump was paying attention at all to how he was answering those questions?
This is politics, pure politics. Trump knew or should have known that Jeff Sessions was the absolute worst choice for that position. But what made him attractive, Sessions, what made Sessions attractive was that he was so utterly gutless, which is one thing. But more than anything else, it had to do with Trump's vision of how he was going to run the Justice Department. He was going to use Sessions as his personal hitman. I don't like Hillary Clinton. You go after Hillary Clinton. That's how he figures he was going to be running this country. That Congress is the same. People he doesn't like, he will get them to be harangued and harassed and prosecuted and all the other evil things that happened to them. You know, it's amazing that when Trump is calling for a lock her up, the fact is he deserves a jail cell right next to hers. He has no reason to believe that he is immune. He is very much as susceptible to indictment as she is. But this was the whole deal. And I think it finally came to a head. Jeff Sessions is in charge of the Department of Justice. Okay. You don't have any rights as a president to go tell people, like, you sick him like he's a bulldog. Go after that guy. Go after that person. Go after that corporation. Squash that investigation. Don't even start another investigation. Who the heck are you? What kind of thing are you running here? You think you're running your business? No, this is a country that has laws, and everybody, including the president, ought to abide by the law. You don't have somebody pointed, which is what he has been doing since he has come into office. He thinks everybody is an employee of his, and he can use them to get accomplished what needs to be accomplished in his advantage. This is bizarre. It is so wrong. And the Congress hasn't done anything about it. This is, you know, it involves obstruction of justice. When the President of the United States, as we saw with Comey, when the President of the United States interposes himself and tries to move an investigation in a particular direction, That is highly illegal. That's obstruction of justice. But Trump does not obey the laws. He doesn't care about the laws. And his whole thing is that the apparatus of government is his personal, part of his personal tool chest. It has nothing to do with how the country is supposed to be operating, and all the care taken to organize a system of government so that everybody understands how they are supposed to operate within this living, breathing organism called government. No. He operates like a thug. I don't like that guy over there. Let's see if we can make a case against him. Let's see if we can destroy him.
Well, that's been done with every administration.
It doesn't make it right.
You know what I mean? Obama went after, and Bush went after, and Clinton went after. I mean, it's all been going on forever, and nothing new under the sun. So
this President Donald Trump is in your face about it.
Okay,
he's
well,
at least
he's exposing
matter.
Stuff that has been being done with a nice little velvet glove before, but maybe now it's more in your face, and that's good. I mean, the deep state has been there since the very beginning of the country, and you know, to show how corrupt everything is.
You're making the case that Trump is entitled to be as crooked as anybody else. That's not a case.
Everybody's been crooked before him, so what's the difference?
I don't care about everybody. I don't care about everybody. I am evaluating the president on the basis of his actions. I find them highly objectionable, illegal, unprincipled, and treacherous. And very dangerous. I said from the very beginning, there's something wrong with this president. You ask anybody listening to this program, there is something wrong. And shortly after that, we have a national body of psychiatrists and psychologists saying the same thing. But people are backing away. Nobody is saying, we think it's time to require the president to undergo some kind of treatment. This is not normal behavior. This is not a guy being quirky. This is a guy displaying very dangerous symptoms that he's out of control. And that is his norm. I don't know. It's like, you know, it's like sitting in the back of a 15-seat van all the way in the back, and the driver is driving like a maniac, and you can't get to the steering wheel, you can't get to the brake, you can't do anything to control this out-of-control vehicle. That's the same feeling that I have, and I'm not the only one.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, because you should have been feeling the same way about Obama and Bush and Clinton before.
I did. Absolutely, I did. Absolutely. I did not vote for Obama. And I had a particular reason for it. Especially as it relates to people of color in this country and outside of it. The Obama's conduct, the conduct of his administration, the attitude of his administration was just contemptuous and hostile. I don't think there was much gained by having him as president, except some kind of an emotional reward. So it's not that I'm very clear. I'm looking at these presidents and these public officers in terms of their conduct, in terms of what they say as opposed to what they do. This president has a lot, I mean, so much going against him in terms of the outrageous things that he has done and gotten away with that should have gotten him impeached a long time ago. But the attitude of Congress is, well, we look at him another 10 months and see how he does. Oh, there's a problem here. And it needs to be addressed. And people are very unwilling to address it. Thanks for your call. Thanks, Jason. Lamont from New York, you're on the air.
How you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'd like to know that, based on the conversations, I don't want to change gears and try to do that, but I may during the conversation. My question is, when did it become standard operating practice? When did it become noble and a badge of honor to systematically gerrymandering votes? When did it become a credible sign of decree, or when did it become a positive thing to actually purge votes and to oppress you know, people from voting? I discussed yesterday about our dear Secretary of State in Georgia, Brian Kemp, who has systematically and deliberately took away about 800,000 votes from the voter pool, 755,000 to be exact, as well as 214 polling sites closed, mostly in Democratic strongholds, not just people of color, black folk, but anywhere where it would be a challenge and jeopardize his chances from re-election. My question is, this has been going on quite some time. There even was a computer programmer who testified how easy it is to hack in these voting machines and to change the election results. It's about maybe 10 to 12 years old, and anyone can check it out on YouTube by just Googling programmer testifies on hacking elections. And a whole bunch of YouTube videos come up. But my question is, this is a constitutionally protected right. And therefore, if it's a constitutionally protected right, like you've been saying before, there is no will or enforcement that I've seen so far from the Democratic side, the DNC, or Republican side, or from law enforcement to indict, arrest, and throw these corrupt politicians in jail.
Well, you answered your own question. That's the answer to the question you raised.
And my next thing is that this is part and parcel of, some people on the call may be offended by this, of the lackluster and the lack of support that you see from those who claim to be liberal, who claim to be progressive. Even conservatives, even those who, such as myself, I'm not a liberal. I'm not a conservative. I'm someone who is into the independent spirit and the entrepreneur spirit of free business, bent ventures, and but I've noticed that those who claim to be for unity and for progressive, they're not honest. They're not loyal, and it falls short even in the private sector. Even in employment. Here we have a situation where people have Trump trauma disorder, or, you know, basically are polarized by the state of affairs. However, it's not translating very well in galvanizing the masses. There was a march yesterday to protect the Mueller investigation. In D.C., in Portland, Oregon, in California, L.A., and New York, there were no black and brown faces or even Asian faces in mass at these marches. And this is 2018, and I've noticed, just an observation, that it's still segmentized. There's still division among these groups who claim to be progressive, who claim to be liberals. There's no movement to bring in the masses on these demographics. Why do you have these protests, if they wish to protest, like yesterday, where it's only Caucasian European faces? And there's not...
Yeah, because they're the ones who organized it.
Well, because they
they're
organized
it. They're the ones who organized it. And they're not exactly
but they exclude others.
But the progressive community is not known actually to live up to the creed that they profess. They should be reaching out to other communities as well. But then there's another part of it. It's a very complicated thing, and yet it's a very simple thing. People don't understand. There are two different, very different worlds. They believe that they can just call for something and it would happen because, well, they'll be there. They have no clue as to how the other America lives and what concerns the other America. Do you think that the Mueller investigation appears high on the list of priorities of people of color? Do you really think that?
Oh, heavens knows.
The interpretation is that this is the white world dealing with its contradictions. And suddenly they want everybody to be concerned because they're concerned. No, it doesn't work like that. When we have issues that are of critical importance, we don't see them. This was one of the major criticisms I had, even of the Green Party. Well, is the Green Party very active and visible in communities of color? No. Are they talking about the issues that are relevant to, not to say that the issue of climate change and so forth, these are unimportant, not at all. But they still have not come to understand and appreciate that when you get out into these communities, you're still talking about you and what concerns you and what is important to you. That is a hell of a way to do community organizing. Try talking to the people about what concerns them. Try forging genuine relationships with communities that incorporate their concerns as well into the big picture. It burns me up no end when people are talking about things that they're doing and then they wonder how come, you know, the black community isn't showing up. I wouldn't show up because you're not talking to me. You're talking at me. And you're talking over me. You're talking in every way except to me. You don't bother to find out what the heck is going on in our communities. And we have not come out of the racially bifurcated America. We still are in apartheid America. Wake up and smell the Bustelo.
So basically you're saying that they're full of crap.
No. I'm saying that for all the smarts that they have, they're not paying attention, or they're not listening. They're expecting different results by living by the same old, tired codes that have been proven so long ago to be really, they're not working.
May I say this?
Sure.
And then I'll leave. Thank you. You've touched on a couple of key points, and these indicators that you mentioned is due to let's say, lack of a better word, of pulling others up to the level of economic prosperity. Those who are deleveraged are economically disadvantaged. Who have college degrees and are well-skilled and articulate.
Oh, you know,
and able
to I've got to interrupt you. Your language is scaring me.
Well, hear me out. I'm not finished.
You're pulling people up. And the assumption, see, this is exactly what's wrong. The assumption.
No, it's not pulling. It's pulling people from the job market point of view. The reason why people of color, black people in brown are not interested in Mueller's investigation is because they're interested in surviving, and they should not be this way in 2018. Why is one segment of the community? Why is one segment of our community who are progressive and liberals are gainfully employed, affluent and prospering? However, they expect on a dime, just like you said, they expect on a dime, on a phone call to galvanize the troops. And take for granted the black and brown community when they have been deleveraged out of positions of employment or of prosperity, where in fact they will not have to worry about who's going to pay the light bill, who's going to pay for the tuition, or is food in the grocery? Are they being harassed by housing court because they are gainfully employed? And that's what's lost in translation. That the actual loss in translation, or the connections of one grassroots community allowing those who are black and brown to have secured steady employment or business ventures, so they are not constantly struggling or in strife. When you have
The issue of survival has been our top priority since day one.
Yes. And but they're not hearing that. They're not interested in that.
Part of the business of survival is having to put up with people, sometimes well-meaning people, who have no clue about how you relate to each other. Just how you relate to each other. Recently, a new neighbor. I got a new neighbor. Okay. He had gone. I'd seen him around, and but never said anything. He's white. So one day I said to myself, "Let me go." I ring his bell, and he comes to the door. I said, "I just wanted to introduce myself, since you haven't introduced yourself. But we are neighbors." He looked at me as if he was so stunned. A simple thing, a simple transaction of saying, "Hey, I'm Mary," and "Hey, I'm Joe." It's a simple thing. But the whole idea that he could not configure in his head that what I was talking to him about was how the basics of how to be a neighbor, that totally went over his head. He had no idea of how to be a neighbor, or
some lack social civility.
So yeah. These are the elemental things that we have to deal with in the course of trying to forge some kind of relationship out there. But I tell you, one of the best ways to start is to go and talk to people. What is the big complication about that? Thanks, Lamont, for your call today. Thank you so much for calling in. Marty from Connecticut, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice. How are you today?
Okay. How are you, Marty?
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. As always, it is a pleasure and an honor.
Same here.
Thank you. Thank you. You're too kind. Well, listen, I want to touch upon two things as sort of food for thought. The first being, and I've heard it referenced on this show and others regarding former President Obama's federal judgeship vacancies. And it struck me that 81 would seem like a lot of judgeships to leave open, and especially with 2020 hindsight going, oh my God, couldn't anybody would say, why in the world would you leave these things available for a person like President Trump? And so I had to do a little digging because I wanted to better understand the issue. And what I found was somewhat fascinating, which I'll share with the audience. Obama, according to the statistics that I was able to find, got 329 judgeships confirmed. They have to be confirmed through the Senate. And I guess that's the punchline in all of this. And I won't bore the audience with all the details about which court. But essentially, 329 approved, 81 left vacant. So I says, well, why 81 left vacant? How does that compare to other presidents in the final, say, 2 years of their term? And quite honestly, it led me to a report by the Brookings Institute, which indicated that, and I guess the headline is, Senate obstructionism handed a raft of judicial vacancies to Trump. And they go into detail about what the Senate did and wouldn't and didn't do in the process. And then it provided numbers from Reagan, George W., and the like, essentially acknowledging that what President Obama was up against was fairly formidable with respect to getting those 81 that we're referencing done. And I suspect also that, like a lot of people, the former president believed that with Clinton being the front runner and most likely to win in their minds, that there wasn't an urgency to do that. For all I know, there may have been some agreements or some arrangement or whatever. But I don't believe that, though I have plenty of complaint with the former president on issues, I don't believe it was his intent to leave 81 vacant positions directly for Trump to have fulfilled. That's my first point, Mike.
All right. And well, let me respond to that. I think, here's how I'm thinking. Everything you say might actually be true, that he was, he was a target of a lot of obstructionism so that he couldn't get done a lot of the things he wanted to get done. But he was in office for 8 years. Eight. And you can't tell me that you can't get this. I mean, you're a president. You're leaving the whole thing. This is why he has he's getting all excited now about leaving something of the record to reflect what happened and what he did and so forth. He's got a foundation. He's got this presidential archive and building and all that to say, these are the great things that I accomplished when I was in office. He had 8 years. 8 years. And beginning his term, that's the first thing that you look around for. Why? Because you are also looking, the same thing that Trump is doing, you pack the courts with people that you think you want in there for whatever reason. I find it impossible. I can't accept that a president after 8 years would close the doors behind him with 81 vacancies, federal vacancies, that would have outlasted quite a few other presidents, perhaps, and two U.S. Supreme Court positions. He can't explain that to me at all.
I'd like to take a shot at that. As I indicated, for every vacancy that you're referencing, he was able to get through over four candidates confirmed in the Senate that was obstructionist.
And, right, but I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking 81.
But that's not the number of 81. But you're not comparing it to what other presidents who faced opposition party Congresses got through. So it would be unfair to take 81 doesn't mean anything. If I said to you he got 80% of his appointments confirmed, you would say 80%. Okay, not an A, but a B. But when you say 81, not in the context that over 410 are the issue that we are raising, confirms against vacants, I'm just saying I don't know how much the Senate process slowed him down. I don't know how much the belief that another Democratic president would be next in line, but I can also say I got to compare, like in baseball, you got to call balls and strikes. So if you tell me that the pitcher had 329 strikes and 81 balls, what am I to conclude if that's what the numbers that I have to work with?
Well, he got over 80%. Here's how I think.
Okay.
You came in on a groundswell of support. No other president really in modern times has received this level of support from the people. You come in as the agent of change, and you are telling people that you have a whole different vision and you need their support, and they would have supported you. It shows that your Democratic Party is not working. You had
possibly
8 years.
Here's what I don't know, and I would suggest should be factored into the discussion. You don't know the distribution of the vacancies. In other words, vacancies come up. The vacancies weren't there when he first came in office. They came throughout his two terms. So you're making the assumption that he should have gotten it done with the groundswell of being elected, and one could equally say these vacancies came up in the last 2 years, and there was an election going on. There was additional Senate obstruction at a higher level than when he first came in. Those are all I'm saying is that it isn't 81 stands alone. It's 81 in the context of other presidents, the number approved that he did get through, and how those 81 were distributed. If the 81 were ones that were there in his first term, then I would think he should have there should be some discussion. But I don't know that. And all I'm bringing up is he did
get 300.
You have a
point about it's possible that that number of 81 might have been an accumulative number reflecting vacancies that became available over time. It still doesn't change my argument. My argument is, as a president coming in, and he's a lawyer, he ought to know the importance of the courts, and the federal courts especially. This should have been a top priority item. And
but
this
which,
should
what
be
item,
where
how do we know that it was an item when he came in? How many vacancies were there when he came in?
A top priority item to get done, to get it done. There's no excuse.
But I'm asking, what was it that he was
done
if there were no
out of time? No, what I would do is you have You organize your, you know how Washington works better than anybody else. You organize a strategy. You have a strategy to get this done. Look, Donald Trump comes in, under 2 years, he got all this done, including two U.S. Supreme Court justices' names. So it means that people are working, they have a strategy, and they're going after the goal with great aggression because they think that this is going to be very, very important for them to take credit for and to seal, to put the imprimatur on the administration. That's how this politics works. But you walk out the door with 81 judgeships and two U.S. Supreme Court slots available, and I'm supposed to be impressed? I'm supposed to be impressed about the fact that you got all these other appointments made? Look, we got to get serious. We got to get serious. That's my point. And that brings us to the end of our program today. Thanks so much for joining me and for really making this a great exchange for opinion, information, and ideas. Have yourselves a great weekend. Surround yourselves with positive people, and we'll see each other Monday. Bye-bye.